balance is keeping the right amount of oil in the tank and removing the bulk of the threat.
A plan to draw down oil at the Drift River Terminal near Mount Redoubt. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 31st of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, conservation groups plan to sue over an Endangered Species Act decision on the ribbon seal.
This really is a litmus test about how the Obama administration is going to deal with global warming.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The U.S. government has filed a civil lawsuit against BP Exploration, alleging violations of federal clean air and water laws. The lawsuit was filed today in U.S. District Court in Anchorage. It alleges the company illegally discharged more than 200,000 gallons of crude oil from pipelines onto the North Slope during two major oil spills in 2006. The government claims BP failed to prepare and implement spill prevention and control plans in accordance with good engineering practices. It also claims the company didn't implement some required spill prevention measures under the Clean Water Act. BP spokesman Steve Reinhart provided a written response to questions, stating the company has taken steps to make sure operations are safe and reliable and protect the environment. He gave no comment on the legal issues. Officials are working out a plan to remove oil from the tanks at the Drift River Oil Facility, which is located in a precarious position below Redoubt Volcano. About 6 million gallons of crude is currently sitting in two tanks at the facility. Three other tanks on site are empty and cleaned, APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The problem is being addressed by a unified command that includes the terminal's owner, Cook Inlet Pipeline Company, the U.S. Coast Guard, and the State Department of Environmental Conservation. Gary Folley is with the state.
All of us in the unified command are committed to remove oil at the Drift River Terminal to the maximum extent that is safe.
A tanker is expected to begin drawing down the oil within the next week. Joseph Loschuto is a Coast Guard commander who visited the site yesterday. He says the group is still working out exactly how much oil to remove. He says some oil is necessary to stabilize the tanks in the event of a flood. That's a scenario that played out during the flooding that followed Hurricane Katrina.
So the balance is keeping the right amount of oil in the tank and removing the bulk of the threat, but still keeping the tank from floating away should some water intrusion come into the facility and cause it to float up.
The dikes protecting the tanks have held up so far. Loschuto says earlier flooding has actually reinforced them by adding a thick layer of mud along the edge. Each explosion can create a lahar, a fast-moving slurry that melts the volcano's glacier and floods the valley below. John Power is a geophysicist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory. He says scientists are trying to figure out how much of Redoubt's glacier is left to power those floods.
We have hot material coming out from the volcano, mixing with the snow and ash and causing this rapid melting. Certainly, we are currently attempting to assess just how much snow and ice there is and how much potential there would be for continued large flows down the Drift River.
Two teams from AVO flew to Redoubt today to collect ash samples and get a look at the volcano's summit area. Power says Redoubt isn't very active right now. It's sputtering steam and ash clouds to relatively low altitudes. But he says that doesn't mean it's done erupting.
We do expect the volcano to remain active over the next days to weeks. We are in a bit of a lull today. Things have quieted down significantly, but we do expect things to continue, and we'd really encourage people to continue to prepare for additional large explosive events that may spread ash, significant ash throughout South Central Alaska and perhaps beyond.
Even as officials are planning to remove oil from the tanks at Drift River, they're also working out a system for continuing to use the storage tanks there as the eruption cycle stretches on. Gary Folley with DEC says the team is looking at ways to minimize the environmental risk.
One of the priorities would be to limit the amount of time that oil would stay at the terminal. For instance, you know, a tanker could be stationed at the Christie Lee platform, and as the oil flows into the Drift River Terminal, is quickly put onto a tanker.
The environmental group, Cook Inlet Keeper, has criticized state and federal managers for not having sufficient response capabilities nearby in case a large oil spill does occur. Commander Loschuto says the Coast Guard has equipment close enough in Anchorage and California.
I could, if I wanted to put on a big show, take all this gear and deploy all this gear down to the Kenai Peninsula. That's going to cost the taxpayers a lot of money, and it's something that we don't deem at this time as necessary to do, especially since we know that in 8 hours I can get it there if there's an emergency.
Critics have also questioned the wisdom of building an oil terminal at all at the base of an active volcano. Officials say they won't address that issue until the current emergency is taken care of. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Conservation groups announced today they are planning to file a lawsuit to list the ribbon seal under the Endangered Species Act. Greenpeace and the Center for Biological Diversity hope their intent to sue will convince the new Obama administration to grant federal protections to the ribbon seal. The Bush administration denied the species listing under the ESA in December during its final days in office. Melanie Duchin is with Greenpeace in Anchorage.
What we're doing is we're pretty much testing the waters here with the Obama administration, and this really is a litmus test about how the Obama administration is going to deal with global warming, and we're hoping it's going to be very different from the way the Bush administration dealt with global warming.
Ribbon seals live mostly in the Chukchi and Bering Seas and don't spend any time on land. They haul out on ice to give birth and fatten their pups in the spring and then pass the rest of the year foraging in the open ocean. Not much is known about ribbon seals, but the federal government says there are about 200,000 worldwide. Duchin says under former President Bush, federal agencies spun science to suit their own agendas. But she says it's clear global warming and sea ice melt are having dramatic effects on ribbon seals.
The Endangered Species Act is a law that's based 100% on science. And if you look at the science of global warming and sea ice decline and the ribbon seal, I could drive a truck into here with the amount of information that says that the ribbon seal needs to be listed. So given those two things, I think it's very likely that the Obama administration will do the right thing.
Federal officials acknowledged receiving the 60-day notice from the conservation groups outlining their intent to sue, but they won't comment on it. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is also currently considering Endangered Species Act listing proposals for ringed, spotted, and bearded seals. Those decisions are expected sometime this spring. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Nordic skiers tackle a tough course at U.S. Nationals in Fairbanks.
I just tried to ski hard, and sometimes it works, or you can come up from behind, and sometimes you just never catch them, and today it worked.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
President Obama's nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services pledged today to work on the problems that Alaskan Medicare cardholders are having in getting doctor's appointments. Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius underwent her first round of questioning by a Senate committee this morning. She promised swift action to fix the nation's healthcare system and said preventative care and universal coverage will be key to reducing long-term costs. Sebelius made her comments before the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski is a member of. Murkowski brought up the serious shortage of doctors in Alaska that will still take Medicare patients. Medicare is supposed to provide health insurance coverage to Americans age 65 and over once they stop working or who meet other special criteria. But Murkowski said in Anchorage, most providers are no longer accepting new Medicare patients. The main problem is the rate at which doctors are reimbursed.
Because right now, in the largest city in my state, having that Medicare card means nothing if they can't get into a provider. And right now, they can't. So what do we do?
Well, Senator, I appreciate your concern, and it is a huge concern and one that I share. Clearly, having a card does you little good if you can't see a doctor can't get the care that has been promised to you by that card.
Sebelius said it's a problem being faced in other parts of the country, often in rural areas, and said she'd like to help resolve it.
I can assure you, if confirmed, I would love to work with you on that.
A recent study by the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute for Social and Economic Research, or ICER, showed only 13 primary care doctors in Anchorage will now see new Medicare patients. The reimbursement to physicians increased on January 1st of this year, but the ICER study showed that that has not had much of an impact. Governor Sebelius asked Murkowski whether the recent reimbursement boost has helped. The senator says she believes it's helping doctors keep patients but not take on new ones.
What we were seeing last year was folks who had gone to the same provider for 10, 15 years. They're fine as long as they don't hit that magic age of 65, but when that birthday rolls around, their doctor tells them, "I'm sorry, I'm not able to see you." We think that we may have stemmed that. That in fact they are willing to keep their existing patients on, but we're not able to add anyone new, which is a very, very serious problem.
Murkowski invited Sebelius to visit Alaska and see the situation for herself. She also invited the nominee to the state to see achievements made in delivering health care through telemedicine. Kathleen Sebelius faces a second confirmation hearing this week before the Senate Finance Committee, but her ultimate confirmation is expected to go smoothly. She is President Obama's second choice for Health and Human Services Secretary. Former South Dakota Senator Tom Daschle dropped out last month after his tax records were scrutinized. A scientist with the Center for Alaska Native Health Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks has been awarded $2.8 million from the National Institute of Health to study why Yupik Eskimo people struggle with high rates of obesity but have lower incidences of type 2 diabetes than others. Bert Boyer is the co-director of the center and studies molecular biology. Although he suspects the Yupik distinction is linked to a marine subsistence diet, he is also looking for genetic protective factors that may be at work in people living in the Yukon-Kuskokwim area.
Markers specific in the blood that are very healthy Yupik Eskimos are their HDL levels. It's what we call the healthy or the good cholesterol, and their levels are significantly higher than the general population. And triglycerides, which could lead to heart disease, are significantly lower, which is also very healthy.
How does this compare to other Alaska Native people?
It looks like from the data from the diabetes prevention program at ANTHC in Anchorage that diabetes prevalence is a little lower in Yupik Eskimos than in other Native groups, but the percent increase in diabetes prevalence is just as great among Yupiks as other Alaska Native groups. So it's a time to act now and to try to find what the protective factors are and what the risk factors are, and then, of course, avoid the risk and enhance the behaviors associated with the protective effect.
And so what will the focus of your research be? How are you going to go about trying to tease out this information?
So my background is in molecular genetics, and I'm interested in genetic risk factors for obesity. Turns out about 70% of the variation in an individual's body weight is genetically influenced. But that doesn't mean if you have risk factors or risk genes for obesity that you're, you know, predetermined to become obese. It's, as I tell people, the genes are the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger. And so what that basically means is your behaviors, your environmental influence is very, very important depending upon your genetic risk. So people more predisposed to obesity should watch their weight more, should eat healthy foods, avoid saturated fats, things like that. So I'm specifically interested in the interactions between protective environmental factors like polyunsaturated fats in a marine subsistence diet and genetic risk factors for obesity.
Do you plan to do some comparative studies using the same type of process with other Alaskans?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's another study called the Genetics of Coronary Artery Disease in Alaska Natives, which is based in the Norton Sound region. And they're very interested in basically comparing some of the results that they're getting to the results that we're getting. And then as a geneticist, what we do when we find something that we think is significant, we want to replicate in several other population groups, not just Alaska Natives, but American Indians in the lower 48 or, you know, Caucasians worldwide.
And Do you think that similar results might be found in other coastal people who have a largely ocean subsistence lifestyle, or do you think that there's some genetic distinction that only Yupik people seem to have?
Well, you're asking me to guess a lot here, but as long as it's understood as a guess, my hunch is there's nothing genetically unique about Yupik Eskimos, but there's something special about their diet or their activity patterns. And so that's the other thing that we're doing that I haven't mentioned is we use heart rate movement monitors to very precisely measure physical activity and energy expenditure associated with Yupik activities. And the preliminary results, to my surprise, suggest that Yupik Eskimos are very active. They well exceed the minimum standards set forth by the Department of Health and Human Services for moderate physical activity levels. And so I think it's some combination of activities and foods that they eat that is driving this protection. I don't think that it's a specific genetic predisposition to avoid diabetes.
How are you hoping that this research might ultimately help others that are struggling with diabetes and obesity?
Yeah, I think if we can learn some of the secrets that the Yupiks have in terms of avoiding diabetes, even with, you know, increases in obesity and overweight, if we can learn what are some of the protective factors that might prevent diabetes, I think that will be very applicable to other population groups. It's going to take time. We have a lot to learn, but that's really the basis of the talk this afternoon, sort of sharing some of the things that we're learning. And they're really the simple things, you know, returning to your subsistence foods, keeping an active lifestyle, and, you know, learning from your elders.
Bert Boyer is a genetic researcher and co-director of the Center for Alaska Native Health Research at UAF. He will be giving a public talk this evening in Anchorage entitled What Yupiks Can Tell Us About the Risk and Protection for Obesity. It takes place at the Begich Middle School at 7 p.m. The top two legislative leaders met with Governor Sarah Palin today, catching up on their meeting that was canceled last week. House Speaker Mike Chenault and Senate President Gary Stevens were the only legislators present. Stevens said they left without clear answers to questions they wanted to discuss relating to the governor's willingness to use federal economic stimulus money that she has not yet accepted.
We did not get a clear answer to that, and I think it's only because neither the governor nor us fully know the implications of some of these pots of money. We just don't know the answer to it, and we can't get the answer from the federal government. There's I think, difference of opinion and different answers you get on different days, and so we just don't know the answer to that. And I think that the governor has certainly not said, she has not said that she would not veto anything. You know, I think she'll be looking very closely at that. And as we go down the road, we'll have more information than we have at this juncture.
The governor also talked with Stevens and Chenault about legislation that she would like to see passed this year. Stevens says that her support for the measures will enter the mix for the end of the session, but says some of her priorities are not likely. The governor has pointed to 8 issues, ranging from divestiture of investments in Sudan to redefining the purpose of the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. Stevens says some of those bills will pass, but it's too late to promise passage on some of her priorities. For example, a bill combining electric utilities along the rail belt into one corporate structure. Action on that bill is waiting for resolution of some outside problems.
We've assumed that the utilities in the rail belt are not quite ready to move ahead. There seemed to be some disagreement there. So we thought we had another session to actually deal with that.
The leaders have another meeting set up with the governor for Thursday. Finance chairman and majority leaders will also attend that session.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Stringent pollution control standards will remain in law under changes made last week to a bill altering Alaska's cruise ship wastewater rules. But environmental regulators will be allowed to bend the rules until new technology becomes available. The measure has cleared its last House committee, and the next stop is a floor vote. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The bill addresses rules set by a citizens' initiative passed by voters in 2006. Cruise lines say they cannot meet new limits for ammonia and dissolved metals that will take effect next year. Environmental Conservation Commissioner Larry Hartig told lawmakers that a new amendment to the bill maintains high standards.
It retains the at-the-point-of-discharge requirement. You know, cruise ships will still be required ultimately to meet that at-the-point-of-discharge standard. But in the interim, they would be allowed relief from that if DEC finds, you know, that they are employing the most effective technology that is both technically and economically feasible.
The original legislation proposed dropping requirements that the standards be met in undiluted discharges. Cruise lines instead wanted mixing zones, which lower wastewater concentrations. Hartig says his agency wants to create standards that can be met while pushing for improvements.
The idea is that we want to progress as quick as technology will allow us to meeting the at the point of discharge for all pollutants. We know we're not there now. Our technology conference says they can't achieve that now. But how do we get there?
The bill was sponsored by Valdez Republican John Harris, who proposed the amendment during a House Resources Committee hearing. Harris says his changes are a realistic compromise between the industry's requests and the initiative's requirements. He says they do not promote pollution or lower environmental standards.
It advocates for more stringent regulation up to the 2010 standard when those technologies are available and when they can be put on the ships in an economic manner, and that also fit the ships from point of view of size and whatever.
Experts say existing technology can help meet the standards that kick in next year, but it's not ready for installation on ships, and it may not be affordable. Hartig says a science panel created by the amendment would follow the development of such improvements. House Resources Committee member Scott Kawasaki, a Fairbanks Democrat, worried that the bill would do little to encourage improvements.
If we basically reduce the standard, in this case, by allowing an industry to have this exception under these rules, then what's the incentive for the cruise ship industry to continue to do a good job in pursuing technology?
Backers of the bill said it needs to be passed this session to prevent schedule changes that could hurt Alaska communities during the 2010 cruise ship season. In Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
The National Cross Country Ski Championships wrapped up in Fairbanks last weekend. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the four-race series culminated in long-distance events that challenged North America's best skiers with relentless terrain.
The courses at the Birchill Recreation Area included thousands of feet of vertical gain and steep pitches that reduced even Olympians to a slow shuffle on the toughest climbs. Sunny skies and warmer temperatures eased the pain for racers in Sunday's marathon events, which started before big crowds. The race courses wound back and forth, giving spectators near continuous opportunity to watch the racers suffer through the hills. Canadian Stefan Kuhn and Ivan Babakov posted the fastest times in the men's 50-kilometer event, but a minute and a half behind them, Anchorage Olympian James Southam captured his second gold medal of the four-race championships as the first American. Southam says he worked hard the whole race to catch and pass U.S. junior skier Noah Hoffman.
I just tried to ski hard, and sometimes it works where you can come up from behind, and sometimes you just never catch him, and today it worked.
Southam's two golds at Nationals punctuate a return to the top since winning his first U.S. titles in 2005 and 2006. 19-year-old Noah Hoffman of Colorado held on for the silver in the marathon.
You know, maybe I shouldn't have led so much because I couldn't quite hold it together, but it was hopefully sometime soon I'll be able to hold that pace all the way through. Definitely my best 50K ever, my best race at the U.S. Nationals ever, so that's good.
Dartmouth skier Glenn Randall strided to the bronze as the third American, while young Alaskans Max Treinen and Patrick Johnson of Anchorage and David Norris of Fairbanks notched 11th through 13th positions overall in the marathon. In Friday's skiathlon event, Ivan Babakov was dominant. The Russian, who recently became a Canadian citizen to join his family in Alberta, is coming off a solid season on the international race circuit.
I'm really proud to be Canadian now, and that was one of my best season so far and on the World Cup. It was really long and tough. I'm tired and looking forward to rest, but it was a good season.
Behind Babakov in the skiathlon, Leif Zimmerman of Montana claimed his fourth career U.S. title. He says he survived a war of attrition on the trails as the temperature cooled Friday night.
It's getting a little colder out there. Everybody was hurting from a long season and, feeling the bonk a little at the end. So it was a fight those last couple laps, but I wasn't the only one hurting. So, and I knew that, so I tried to push as hard as I could.
Behind Zimmerman, Southam and Lars Flora of Anchorage took the other two U.S. podium spots in the men's skiathlon Friday. Anchorage skiers Brent Knight and Bart Dangle also had top 15 results in the skiathlon. One name missing from the top of the standings during nationals was Tyson Flaherty of Fairbanks, who struggled during the week. He says fatigue from a series of marathons left him feeling flat.
I put a little bit too much out there, and I've been paying for it.
Flaherty says he isn't giving up and will build upon what was otherwise a solid season with smart training this summer.
Just kind of got to keep on the same track and go into the winter feeling really good and have a lot of volume and intensity and a lot of good training under my belt, so try to get the best out of everything for next year.
On the women's side, Vermonter Liz Steven of the U.S. ski team continued her dominance over the weekend. Stevens claimed her third U.S. championship gold of the series by edging teammates Morgan Arotola and Anchorage's Keegan Randall in the 30-kilometer marathon. Steven, who also won Friday's skiathlon, repeated her 2008 sweep of the distance events at Nationals in Fairbanks. She says she likes the grueling courses at Birch Hill.
Doesn't really give anyone a break, including me, and I think it really tests how in shape you are and how much you can hurt out there, which I like to test, just hurting and hurting some more.
Alaskans also posted strong results on the women's side over the weekend. Last week, silver medalist in the 10K, Becca Roraba of Fairbanks, was eighth in both the marathon and skiathlon races, capping a stellar week for the 19-year-old, who could be headed for the world stage next.
I'm pretty excited about it. It'd be cool to make these next Olympics, but I have plenty more time to try to make Olympics and, potentially try to do well at them.
Several of Roraba's teammates from the Alaska Pacific University program in Anchorage also skied well over the weekend. Holly Brooks, Taslina Mannix, Kate Fitzgerald, and Kate Pearson-Arducer all logged top 20 results. Pearson-Arducer, who grew up in Fairbanks but now lives in Cordova, says she'll be training hard this summer in anticipation of the Olympics.
I wear dishwashing gloves when I roller ski because it pours rain on me. And the mountains are pretty steep, so I found that pretty challenging. I just take advantage of what I have.
The 29-year-old Pearson-Arducer says she'll be tweaking the training schedule that's improved her skiing performance dramatically in recent years in hopes of making the 2010 Olympic team. The results from the national championship races in Fairbanks will figure strongly in the selection of the team for next year's games. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.